Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The debate isn't really whether the government should be involved in the economy anymore, right? It already is. The question is, how deep? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today, the 9th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with industrial policy, manufacturing and technology, artificial intelligence in this digital age as well, and what may well be the government's biggest investment in American industrial policy ever. The Senate has passed, as you've surely heard, the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act with a surprising, shocking, really, amount of bipartisan support, an indicator of how important Congress thinks this is. A quarter of a trillion doesn't really sound like much when you compare it to all the virus relief bills, right? But $250 billion is real money. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, there is some real strategic industrial need here, too.
China's government has an explicit national policy saying it wants to be the world leader in things like artificial intelligence. It's throwing a lot of resources at this, and scientists and politicians in the U.S. are concerned. Daniel Castro is with the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation.
The U.S. is doing pretty well right now in this global race for AI. And so the challenge isn't really where we are today, but it's where we're going to be in 10 years.
U.S. government funding for basic research has been declining for decades.
There's no question that we need to be investing more, especially in this moment when we're being challenged by global competitors like China.
Caleb Watney is with the Progressive Policy Institute. The Senate would increase the National Science Foundation budget by 30%. Only a small portion of that increase goes to general scientific research. Most, $29 billion over 5 years, goes to a new technology directorate focused on 10 specific cutting-edge areas. That includes artificial intelligence. Samuel Hammond at the Niskanen Center says the government could and should spend more.
The technology director, the original idea was to provide it $100 billion over 5 years. But in the process of this moving through Congress, that was really curtailed. It was really cut back.
He says there are other areas of American scientific research that need major overhauling. The fact that scientists who get government grants have to spend 40% of their time applying for and managing those grants through a highly bureaucratic process. Others point out that the U.S. trains the world's brightest science students, but doesn't have a visa program to reliably keep them here. Raphael Reif is president of MIT.
We are on a science and technology race for the future. It is with science and technology that we address things like COVID and the biggest challenges the world has, the health of our economy, our security. That is key to all of the above.
In this millennium, countries don't get much by conquering territory. The war for your country's prosperity is fought in the lab and the marketplace. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The big headlines out of President Biden's trip to Europe that started today are going to be geopolitics. That is just the way presidential trips go, and we get that around here. But spare a thought, would you, for trade? Because I'll tell you what, the White House is, specifically the tariffs that the U.S. and the European Union are still hitting each other with on everything from airplanes to motorcycles to hard liquor. And oh, by the way, consumers are still paying those tariffs. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more on how both sides are looking for a trade war truce.
Fond of provolone, a fan of Bordeaux, then you felt the sting of tariffs.
I will confess that we purchase a lot of wine and cheese in our household.
Lynn Fisher Fox is a partner and trade lawyer at the law firm of Arnold & Porter. She's been following a trade dispute over Europe's subsidies for Airbus and U.S. support for Boeing that resulted in 25% tariffs on certain European products like wine and cheese and EU tariffs on U.S. goods.
And these huge volumes on really important products for both countries likely caused political pressure.
The two sides have already agreed to suspend these tariffs until July. Now the EU is calling on President Biden to work toward resolving the aircraft dispute during a meeting next week. But don't uncork that French champagne yet. The two sides are also bickering over U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum. Jennifer Hillman is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
All steel and aluminum coming in from the European Union is being assessed, a 25% tariff on steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum.
Hillman says there's talk of a self-imposed December 1st deadline for resolution of the steel and aluminum dispute. Wendy Cutler, vice president of the Asia Society Policy Institute, says even a little nudge from President Biden would be significant.
Now, as a former trade negotiator, when the president of the United States says, do everything you can to resolve a dispute, the pressure's on to find a solution.
Otherwise, those tariffs on EU products that were suspended will snap back, and you'll pay even more for your Bordeaux and provolone. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street was fine today, a little up, a little down. The real thing you want to be keeping an eye on is inflation. The Consumer Price Index comes out tomorrow morning. It's going to be up. Maybe a lot year on year because last year was terrible and this year isn't. Spoiler alert, by the way, on all the headlines and newscasts, you are going to hear about it until you hear us, of course. We are not going to know for like months, a lot of months, whether rising prices are here to stay or, and this is the magic word, transient. Wall Street, I mentioned, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Lumber's been in the headlines, as you know, record highs for 2x4s and planks and all the rest of the stuff you need to build a home or renovate it in an oh-so-hot housing market. But that is not the whole lumber story. Katrina Amaral runs a sawmill called Timberdoodle Farm up in Stratford, New Hampshire. And when we talked the other day, I asked her where her business stands in an industry dominated by big lumber.
In the sawmill world, we're probably more like a small organic farm that does wholesale to restaurants and like a CSA. It's a bit more like a microbrewery compared to a big beer company.
I'm a big fan of microbreweries, so you're on the right interview. What do you do then? I mean, do people bring boards to you and ask you to, or bring logs to you and ask you to cut them down? How does it work?
There's a wide variety of options, and we stay small so that we can stay flexible. Sometimes people do have trees cut down in their yards, and then they bring them to us for custom sawmilling. Sometimes we do logging, and sometimes we buy in logs for really specific custom orders.
How has the pandemic changed, if it has, what you do at Timberdoodle?
There was definitely an impact from the pandemic for a couple of different reasons. A lot of the bigger lumber yards started restricting in-person shopping. And so especially professional woodworkers, they came to us a little more than normal. A lot of people were buying lumber for desks, as you can imagine.
Oh, yeah.
We saw a spike in demand for flooring, definitely for raised bed lumber, for gardening, and a lot more people looking to take down their own trees and then turn them into lumber.
So when we see, and when people hear on Marketplace, all the reporting about lumber prices going through the roof and that's impacting home construction and all of that, are you seeing that? What does that look like from where you sit?
It's definitely very different for us. The really big spikes in lumber prices are, you know, publicly traded lumber. Mm-hmm. So we're mostly seeing that effect from customers not questioning our prices as much. You know, our cost of production is a lot higher than a big automated mill. And so now that those prices have increased a lot, we don't get really any pushback on what we're charging for lumber.
Right. So you have a little pricing power now, is what I'm hearing.
A little bit.
Fair. You said a minute ago that you're staying small. Do I take that to mean you could ramp up if you wanted to because you got demand? You're just choosing not to? And how come?
It's a couple of different things, I guess. One is that we would have to ramp up an extraordinary amount in order to compete on pricing with big mills. We produce about 100,000 board feet a year, and the really big mills are producing 300 million board feet a year.
Okay.
So that difference is really enormous. But also, it would be really challenging to increase our production without sacrificing our ability to handle the diversity of customers and custom jobs that we currently do.
What is it going to look like for you post-pandemic? I mean, I don't gather it's changed a whole lot for you in the past 15 months. So I imagine the next 15 months aren't going to be that different.
No, we're seeing a lot of change on the increase in home building in our area. There's been a really significant increase in development. And so that has brought with it a fair bit of awareness about where lumber is coming from.
Huh.
You know, you're almost certainly within 10 feet of a timber product right now. And you're also almost certainly have no way of knowing where that product came from, where that tree was growing. So that, I think, has really been the shift for our business.
Katrina Amaral, she runs a smallish lumber mill, sawmill, up in New Hampshire. It's called Timberdoodle. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you miss us on the air or you just want to hear something again, we have a podcast, you know. Check that out, would you? Part of the debate that's being had now in Washington about what government ought to be doing in this economy runs straight downhill to people's quality of life and their bank accounts. Specifically, government help in a pandemic and not in a pandemic. More than 24 Republican governors have pulled their states out of pandemic-related federal unemployment programs, saying, among other things, that those benefits are keeping people from going back to work. Arguments like that have been made against other social programs as well, mostly in the before times. They are why, those arguments are, they're why able-bodied adults without dependents are required to work before they can get food benefits. SNAP is what those benefits are called. But a study out of the National Bureau of Economic Research shows that those work requirements for nutrition assistance don't actually lead to more people working. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
That finding is something Adam Morgan at the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank says he sees all the time. Work requirements can do the opposite of getting more people to work.
Reducing access to nutritious food does nothing to help a person find adequate employment. Removing their source of nutritious food only makes it harder for people to find consistent, stable employment.
The researchers found no evidence that people are any more likely to start working when they lose SNAP benefits. Adam Levy worked on the study. He's also a professor at the University of Virginia.
If the goal is to encourage people to work, then this is not a policy that is working as intended.
And on top of that, work requirements
are indeed a direct cause of many people leaving SNAP.
Elena Prager is a professor at Northwestern and another of the researchers.
Almost a quarter of people who are on SNAP end up losing their SNAP benefits as a direct result of work requirement implementation.
And adults who are homeless are the most likely to lose their food assistance, says Mary Zaki at the University of Maryland, who also worked on the study.
This is a population that obviously has their own barriers to obtaining housing. So some of those barriers may also prevent them from joining the workforce.
Given that, Zaki says taking food assistance away from people who aren't working just leads to greater food insecurity. Congress temporarily suspended work requirements for SNAP last March. They're set to kick back in a month after the government decides the pandemic is over. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Speaking of things being over, by the way, the National Bureau of Economic Research, which did that study, their business cycle dating committee gets to decide when recessions start and when they end. We're still waiting on that. Coming up,
we think things are going to kind of stabilize a little bit.
Man, I hope so. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lopped off 152 points, 0.4%. Good word, lopped off. Closed at 34,447, did the blue chips. NASDAQ dipped 13 points, about a 0.1%, 13,911. The S&P 500 off 7 points, just under 0.2%, 42.19. More than 2,300 Casey's General Stores dot the landscapes of the Midwest and the South. The convenience store chain is based in Ankeny, Iowa. If I'm mispronouncing that, I apologize to that city. It reported quarterly earnings and revenue above expectations. Sales rose more than 12%, excluding gas, that is. Still, Casey's lost 4.5%. It's about 4,500 nautical miles from the east coast of the United States to Las Toninas, Argentina. That's the route for a new undersea cable that Google is building. Google parent Alphabet up 0.4% today. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-notes. Down at 1.48%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. You might have heard back at the end of May that Beijing had said Chinese couples are now allowed to have 3 children, up from 2, which was up from 1 about 5-6 years ago. The response from those Chinese couples was less than completely enthusiastic, in part because, first of all, here and there, kids are expensive, but also, especially in China, educating those kids can be incredibly stressful. The government has tried to ease the burden, but ambitious parents, being ambitious parents, have been enrolling their kids in extracurricular tutoring. Regulation of the tutoring industry over there has in turn been tightened up, but as Marketplace Jennifer Pack reports, it can be tough for families to opt out.
School's out at a kindergarten in China, but most of the kids are not heading home. Instead, they're going to outside lessons in Chinese, English, math. 3/4 of China's students, from kindergarten to grade 12, attend extracurricular classes. One 9th grader in Beijing, though, does not. Her mom, Wan Changru, says it was a difficult choice.
There is a lot of anxiety, but extracurricular courses cost more than $15,000 a year. I just can't afford them.
The tutoring industry in China is worth around $125 billion a year. No surprise, then, that the top-rated TV series this year is about the education rat race. It's called A Love for Dilemma. And in one scene, a parent tracks down a top tutor in a forest. It's shrouded in mystery. The tutor changes venues for every class and only takes in top students. You see, in China, ACE students also have tutors, just to get extra points. Again, parent Wan Changru.
My daughter is in the best class in her high school, and the teacher requires the average score to be 98%. Of course, this is a rigorous requirement, and the teacher said it is abnormal, but every point counts.
Every point counts because only 60% of 9th graders in China get accepted into senior high schools. Wan Changru's daughter is up against millions of others. So the competition starts really early. There's a scene in the TV series A Love for Dilemma. And a 2-year-old girl tries to make friends with a boy. She speaks to him in English.
Hi, boy. What's your name? How old are you?
He's confused. See, children in China only learn English in school in grade 1 or grade 3. But this girl has had an English tutor from the UK since before she could talk, at 8 months old. Parents say they're just exhausted. Wang Wenjing lives in eastern Shandong province and doesn't send her child to outside classes because she says it's not worth it. Instead, she teaches her daughter on her own.
I read a book while
Now her 5-year-old can read an English book by herself. The mom admits, though, she's not the best guide. She can't speak English well herself, but she's trying.
There are many English words I don't know, so I have to study first before teaching my daughter.
Her daughter's schedule is intense. After kindergarten, she has a two-hour lesson, English one day, Chinese the next, followed by 1 hour of math lessons with her father.
My husband and I are both educators. This kind of training for my five-year-old is hard, even for students in grade two or three. But she won't feel pain after getting used to it.
Getting used to competition is what she means. Children say they're exhausted, too. In the TV series, fifth grader Ziyou stands at a parent-teacher conference to confront his mother.
I don't think my mom loves me. She only loves the me that gets 100%.
It's sort of a wake-up call for parents, but adults say they feel trapped. And this is best illustrated by the CEO of a big company in the TV series.
This is the worry for our generation. Our children may not be able to get into the same schools we went to. When they grow up, their salaries, social standing, and jobs might not be as good as ours. If that happens, I won't be able to accept it.
And that's why even relaxed parents like Wan Changru can't resist extra classes totally. She may not send her eldest to any, but her youngest daughter still takes outside English and math courses. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
If you've tried to buy a bike of late or even parts, hello, you can't see me, but I'm raising my hand here, you most likely were put on a wait list, yes, with a bunch of people also looking to get outdoors or commute to work or just get some exercise, essentially risk-free in a pandemic. Today's installment of our series, My Economy, takes us to Phoenix, Arizona, where Mehdi Farsi runs the State Bicycle Company.
We started seeing increased interest in bicycles around mid to late April of 2020. A lot of folks were still commuting around town and a lot of gyms were closed. So a bicycle was one of the best ways to get your exercise in and enjoy time outside. So compared to normal years, we were seeing 2 to 3 times more site traffic and purchases across the board. With the sharp uptick in demand, that obviously put some strain on the supply chain, leading to shortages, bikes being sold out, longer wait times, and ultimately longer production times. So pre-pandemic, we were looking at 90 to 120 days. And currently, I would say for the most expedient models, we would be looking at 8 months. You know, the bikes require a variety of parts and components like steel and aluminum. Those are in short supply, but where we're seeing kind of the most strain in the supply chain would be with parts like bike chains, tires required for virtually every bike. We're still profitable. However, our costs are definitely higher than they've ever been during the pandemic. Moving forward, we think things are going to kind of stabilize a little bit. But yeah, it's a bit of a balancing act because we obviously don't want to underorder, but also we want to be cautious so that we don't have a huge, huge surplus. We're all really grateful that we're selling a product that helps people with their fitness, with their mental health. And all in all, we like staying busy. We're nimble and we're rolling with the punches.
That was Mehdi Farsi. He's the co-founder of State Bicycle Company out in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, while I've got you, check out our Make Me Smart newsletter, would you, named conveniently after a podcast that Molly Wood and I do? If you want to sign up, which you should, marketplace.org/newsletter. This final note on the way out today, in which women draw the short straw again. Saw this in Bloomberg, a study out of a couple of European universities and research centers into audio quality on video conferencing systems. And you know where this is going, right? Not all sounds, it turns out, that is, not all frequencies carry equally well on those platforms. Women's voices in particular, they wind up sounding less expressive and thus less charismatic and persuasive than men's voices do because, of course, that's the way the technology works. All right, we're out of here, but here is your moment of economic context in which El Salvador leans hard into Bitcoin. The granddaddy of cryptocurrencies is now legal tender in that country, as is the U.S. dollar, by the way. Regular listeners to this program will have heard the lamentations about Bitcoin's unpredictable volatility, which I guess is redundant. You can't have predictable volatility? Anyway, case in point, the law passes, Bitcoin goes up 5%. Just because. Our media production team is Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squalacci, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. They're the ones coming in, so the rest of us don't have to. Because. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.